Hello, welcome back. Today I had the opportunity to interview a GP, a general practitioner. She is currently working as a GP, having been to medical school, decided she wanted to be a surgeon, spent 2 years training to become a surgeon, then took some time out and decided to become a GP. And in the meantime, she's had this idea festering of starting her own business, which I think is fantastic. We got a chance to talk about culture today, talking about how to make people's lives better. And DefenderCast is about business, property, and positive thinking. And this was something really different, but we touched on the business aspect and the positive thinking aspect in from a really just different dimension. So hope you enjoy meeting Dr. Laura David. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to DefenderCast. This is episode 6 of season 2, and I am here with my friend, Dr. Laura David. We've spent some time together today already, which no doubt you will see, but also we will talk about because Laura is doing some really cool stuff. So why don't you just say hello and tell us a little bit about yourself, if you don't mind.
Thank you. Hello, everybody listening to Duncan's podcast. I'm Laura David. I'm a mum and I'm a doctor and I'm a founder of a new business called Smart About Health, which is a business looking at proactive and exciting ways of delivering well-being and health intervention in the workplace. And I'm really excited to come and talk to Duncan today.
I love how you introduce yourself as a mum first and foremost.
Absolutely.
Every time.
Because, you know.
Yeah, it obviously says something about, obviously for all of us as parents, it is fundamentally the most important thing. But I feel like in the kind of health sector, it's also even more makes you who you are.
I think so. And, you know, I absolutely, since having my children, it's completely changed who I am. So, and it is fundamentally the most important thing in life. It's the reason why I get up every day and do what I'm doing in my general practice and why I want to create a business which helps people in the workplace, helps employers understand their employees more. And I wouldn't be, you know, even considering doing these new things if I didn't have children. I didn't have a reason for all of this. Yeah.
Interesting. So let's go back a bit, because you did consider and you followed through on a big plan that you had before you had children. So let's park Smart About Health for a minute, because we're going to come on to that and talk about it a lot, because I feel very strongly about the sort of direction you're heading in with it. So let's lead up a little bit more to your background and experience, or where you're at in your career.
Okay, well, maybe we should work backwards.
Yeah, okay.
But currently I am a fairly newly qualified GP, and I'm working in leafy suburbs of North London in a couple of different circumstances. But looking back, I went to medical school. Maybe looking back to there is a good place to start, because when I went to medical school, I went to medical school in Manchester, which was...
When did you first decide you wanted to go to medical school?
Well, I think, the school that we both went to,
yeah,
it gave me an impression that I should be pushing to go to medical school. You know, they give you some sort of careers advice. I don't know what it's like now. And, you know, I was obviously showing interest in science.
I did not get any careers advice at all at school.
No?
Nothing. Not even, I don't even think they felt interested or bothered. But I'm really interested in how two people could have gone to the same school at the same time and got such a different experience.
Well, but anyway, maybe it would be good to hear your experience as well then. I mean, I suppose I did get some careers advice. I suppose it was fairly limited, but just trying to play on my interests, which were, I was interested in science. You know, I don't know if doing triple science or whatever it was at GCSE makes you interested in science, but obviously I was all right at it. And then I did have an interest in arts and the human side, and it just seemed like a natural thing for me to go to medical school. However, I didn't ever... I'm not one of those people that's got that story, I don't have the story, my whole family are doctors, so therefore I must be a doctor. And I don't have the story, you know, that suddenly I wanted to, you know, help people, I wanted to do good in life, I wanted to achieve that in life. That's not ever been my real desperate passion. Of course, that is all doctors feel, that they want to do those things. But I don't think I ever felt so super passionate that I had to be a doctor. However, I did go to medical school and I really enjoyed it. When you go to medical school, my experience is that you kind of don't really actually get fully prepared to be a doctor. Yes, you're studying medicine and you get exposure, you go on the wards and you know, but you're not actually really prepared to be a doctor by medical school.
Until your entirely. First day at work.
Yeah, your basically. First day at work is like the first day ever.
A medical school, just like really just basic, like it's basically university for medicine, or would you describe it slightly differently?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's within a university, so all the medical schools are part of universities, and it's just the study of medicine, and it's done slightly differently in different schools, but it's not a specific school, but it's just a department, obviously quite a big department, because there's so many medical students. So I did decide to become a doctor, and I don't think it was a wrong choice for me. Absolutely, I'm very, very happy to be a doctor.
Yeah.
I think it's an amazing privilege to have that opportunity and have that relationship with people. But my career wasn't entirely plain sailing and straightforward. I initially wanted to be a surgeon, and I was preparing myself to become a surgeon for a long time, even sort of towards the end of my medical school career, if you want to call it a career, experience. I had decided I wanted to become a surgeon. I chose all my jobs, my house jobs, they call them, sort of looking at the particular areas that I wanted to cover. And then I went off and I started my surgical training for 2 years in Stevenage. And it was a really great place to be a surgical trainee. There's lots of opportunity, had really supportive mostly really supportive consultants. And it was a great place to be. And there's a lot of change happening in surgery. It still is and will be for a time being very male dominated. And probably I'm not helping the statistics because I obviously left to become a GP. It is a great specialty, and it meant a lot to me to try and become a surgeon. I think, you know, the experience of actually having somebody's life there in your hands, their body open in front of you. I mean, let's not get too graphic, but it's unbelievable.
Some people will only be listening, so we're fine.
Yes. Good thing it's only listening. I did my 2 years of training, and in that period of time, my life kind of changed. I got engaged to Ben, my husband now, still going strong.
And that makes one of us.
And, you know, kind of started thinking about my life and how I wanted it to be. And I think just from, you know, medicine puts you on a straight trajectory, and you find it really difficult to actually come off that path. And when you do come off and you start thinking about what else is out there, what are alternative careers, what else is meaningful to me in my life, because that's one thing you absolutely realise as a doctor is that you only have one life.
Yeah.
And you only have one opportunity really in life.
Amazing. It's a huge, and I guess what you're saying, what I'm hearing is it's kind of a huge commitment to say that is the path I'm going, and that maybe there are more sacrifices, if you like, than a sort of normal day-to-day job. Because a lot of what you were just describing actually sounds very similar, I think, to what people go through, going through school, going through university, not really sure exactly, you know, studying a particular subject, not sure exactly where they're going to show up, might do an internship, go and work for a company, and then just not be prepared. I guess nothing prepares you for your job like working.
Absolutely.
But I feel like in medicine, it feels like a much bigger commitment to say, you know, an additional course could be 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years before you actually get the knife in your hand and start pulling the strings, if you like. So there was a point where you thought, I need to make a decision about which way my life's going to go.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think coming back to your point about sort of being just on this pathway from an early age, is that medicine, you know, I went to medical school when I was 18. Really, I had no idea what I wanted from my life.
Yeah.
I mean, luckily, I'm one of the lucky ones that, yes, medicine did turn out to be a good option for me, but there were lots of people along the way that just thought, actually, no, how did I come to this decision? This isn't right for me. And that, I think, you know, looking back, you think, oh, that was, you know, what kind of decision is that? But of course, it's great that somebody was able to make that decision.
It takes a strong person as well to be able to say, actually, that's not what I want to do now. You know, it's not exactly necessarily what I thought, or I hadn't considered what if I was going to be married, or if I had kids coming, what my sort of routine's going to be in my life, and how much time you can dedicate to your kids, and all these things are impossible to consider until it's sitting right in front of you.
Yeah, the more even people tell you, oh, this is what's going to happen in your future, and this is what it's going to be like if you have kids. And of course, you can look to mentors or more senior people to try and get that understanding. But when you're in it, you know, I was just like, okay, I'm a doctor now, and I go to work every single day, literally every single day, and most nights as well. And it is a really big commitment, especially when you're doing night shifts and weekends and long hours, and you just have to roll with it. You kind of don't have any time, space or energy to even think about what else could be out there, what other career options are there, what am I going to be prioritizing in 10 years time. And I suppose that's what happened to me in a way. You know, I felt passionately I wanted to become a surgeon, and I loved my surgical training. But when I started to see this was a point in my life where I had to consider what else I wanted to achieve, I realised for myself, and this isn't necessarily for anybody else, this is just me, that I wasn't going to be able to achieve what I wanted to the level that I wanted by becoming a surgeon. And what that means is, you know, I felt that if I wanted to have children, which obviously I did, because I've got two now, and I don't regret that 1 minute, was, am I going to be able to be a good enough surgeon and a good enough mother?
Yeah.
And I felt that actually I probably wasn't. Yeah. And that was a really hard realisation. And
yeah, and like you said, that's for you. That was something... I'm going to turn this way so I'm not... that's something you clearly... Yeah, and like I said, I think I applaud your sort of openness and honesty in testing yourself, because I think a lot of people get into like this mindset of, well, that's it, I've made that decision now, I've got to live with it.
Yeah.
And that brings me interestingly on to, I guess, a light bulb moment one day going off, where having made this big decision and gone down the GP route, was there an idea about having your own business bubbling in the background, or did one day something happen that you thought maybe there's a life after medicine completely, or not medicine completely, because the business is all about your experience and how to roll that out, but just sort of seeing the side to starting your own company and doing something?
I think, you know, I did decide to do general practice for lots of reasons, mostly because it represented really much better quality of life and flexibility, but also the opportunity to really do whatever you want and to make your life your own. Because when you're in a hospital medicine job, you're dictated, everything is dictated by the hospital policies, you know, you and your colleagues, of course, you're much... So in a way, you're less autonomous in your decision making, not only about your own career moves, but about your patients, because you have to follow all these millions of protocols. And of course, we have ways of doing things in general practice and we follow a general rule, but we're much more autonomous practitioners, and I believe that. But you know, it came to a point where I decided general practice, yes, that's the next best move for me. I obviously had already... been thinking I'm going to get married now. I'm going to have children the next few years, but I suppose I didn't actually have any light bulb moment until I went off on my first maternity leave with my first daughter, who's now 4 and a half and is going to school, and I can't believe how long
scary
she's been in this planet for. But yes, it's actually taking that time out of my medical career, because GP training was the same sort of level of intensity full-time as surgical training. I still did nights, I still did weekends, I still did long hours.
So you don't get a chance to stop and breathe?
No, you don't get a chance to stop and breathe or really consider what else is out there. Although I was fully aware that general practice is going to give me a broader spectrum of opportunity.
Yeah.
And because I had my surgical experience, I knew that I wanted to have an interest in minor surgery or surgery to some degree in my general practice, which is great. You can do that. I do that still. But I didn't really have sort of a thought about, oh, I'm going to go and do something out of medicine at that point. Until I went off with her, I started having some ideas. And my ideas were very much focused about my new experience as a mum, a new mum, and the world that it opens you up to, which is a really scary world. And
for dads as well.
For dads, absolutely. Yeah. Mums and dads. And but for me personally, you know, I was starting to get all these messages as well from my antenatal group and all my friends that all had babies the same age. Because I was a doctor, you know, they were all looking to me for the answers about what am I going to do if my baby's got a cough, or does this poo look normal? You know, I literally, the amount of pictures of nappy content that I've got deleted on my phone. I get a lot of pictures, put it that way. And of course I delete them and don't save them. But, you know, so I started to think this is a real, there's a real market for helping new parents understand more about their own health, their baby's health, and how could I potentially tap into that market and create something that's really relevant and really useful.
Yeah, it's just kind of, you know, I guess it's kind of almost like a TV thing, but like every doctor, they've always got friends calling them 24 hours a day asking, I've got something on my toenail.
That's not a TV thing, I promise you.
So like in real life, I guess, like, I know some of our friends, one particular, might call you a lot and ask a question. I guess, is that happen to you all the time, all day, every day?
A lot of the time. I think it's about how you manage that personally as well, because it, you do get into, or you maybe invite some more sticky situations with that. And giving advice to friends, of course, I will, as much as I can, help friends out.
Sometimes they just need to hear, you need to deal with this properly or independently.
Yeah, well, if you, you know, so, and they really respect, or sometimes you... You might say to them, look, that you really need to get that checked out by your own doctor. Yeah. And they'll respect
just
that.
Having images of, like, your friends coming and showing...
Oh, yeah, look, you get all sorts. we won't discuss that in too much detail. But there's a lot... I would say that 90% of the queries I get from friends now, because most of my friends have got children, it's about their children.
Yeah.
I think that was highlighted today in the session. Children present a lot of anxiety to parents in terms of... In particular, their health, their well-being.
What was your stat around that? 8 people said that...
So, look, there was a study by Neurofence, which they obviously had their own objectives there.
Yeah.
But they looked at 2,000 parents and they did a questionnaire, and it said that 83% of parents, might be more than that, considered their children's health and well-being to be the most important thing in life.
Yeah.
And, you know, that probably does really sum it up, that when you are a parent, that is it. You're now the parent.
Yeah.
I'm a mum,
like
first
said,
and foremost.
Yeah.
And my children mean the most to me in the whole wide world. And my husband has come third after my first two children.
Yeah, just somewhere.
Somewhere down there.
Not,
but yeah.
Not there. Question for you. I don't think people really understand the scale of the size of the NHS. So I'm interested to understand a bit of insight from the inside. Like, what's it like to work... or the largest employer on earth, or definitely up there in the top 2 or 3, I think they certainly have been at some point. Because you touched on policy and procedure. Also, we had a conversation a week or two ago when we were talking about something that I just found impossible to fathom about how much is still written on paper and faxes, which just baffles me. I didn't even know fax machines existed anymore, literally. I wasn't sure if you could even buy one. What's it like to work for the NHS?
No fax machines at TAB then.
No, there aren't. I doubt there's one in the building. In fact, I guess you'd struggle to find one within a mile radius from here, except if there was an NHS hospital nearby.
And there probably is, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So it is an amazing experience, first and foremost, to be part of that, and knowing that what you're doing on a daily basis is hopefully helping people. It's also a really difficult experience because technology and the NHS is really, really behind the rest of the world, probably. But certainly the rest of the private sector is absolutely, you cannot compare the two.
Yeah.
And therefore, there's a lot of inefficiency created in that. And that can be to do with communication. It can be to do with patient records. It can be due to writing patient records. So only recently in the hospital where I did my training... have they moved to electronic records? So everything was written on paper in a file that, you know, God forbid the hospital burnt down, that paper is gone and destroyed and nobody would ever have those patients' records. And, you know, you were there flipping through the notes, writing on the next page, you know, and not a lot of it was being done on electronically. And even in the beginning, I remember when I was a house officer, so this was in 2009, my first job, you know, you couldn't even request an x-ray on the computer system. I had to go down with a piece of paper and take it into the radiology department, the x-ray department, and submit it on paper. And then, you know, it just, all of these inefficiencies, you're not utilizing people to their maximum capability, make it quite a difficult place to work. But creating change in that environment is so difficult because it's such a mass scale.
So difficult and obviously rewarding if you could do, but it's, you know, I've heard people say that it's so big that it's harder to roll out. Obviously sitting here in my high chair, I'm saying, you know, how could that possibly be possible? But it just feels like it's a kind of self-perpetuating problem, if you like, where until a line is drawn in the sand and things need to be done. In the world that we live in, it is so far advanced from electronic note-taking.
Yeah.
Theoretically, doctors would be, like, a microphone would be able to capture the conversation and record everything directly into a client's file. There is so much that could be done.
Yeah.
So that just particularly...
I mean, it is interesting. So there's a lot of innovation going on in the NHS, and in particular in general practice, and some of that's done privately and then bought in by the NHS the concept's been proven to be effective. I mean, you know, one thing that we've adopted now in general practice, and it's really, I think it's brilliant, and I think was maybe met with it was quite sceptical in the beginning because we're all very traditional in our approach, and change isn't always met that with open arms, but now we started text messaging patients. So this is something we have on our desktop. We're still using our PCs in practice. I've suddenly now got two screens on my desk, which is unbelievable. Has revolutionized my practice. But this text messaging system, and it was actually developed by one of my colleagues' husbands, it's really taken off, and you can text message any information to a patient, or let's say you've reviewed their blood test results and you want to text them some of the information, or let's say instead of me, now what I used to do was a patient would come and see me, I wanted to give them a leaflet or some information about the condition that we've just discussed or a medicine that we've just started. So I would print it out and give it to them and staple it if I had time. And, you know, they take it home and they probably just chuck it in the bin. But now I can just text message them a link to the information. There's loads of things that can be done on text, and as long as they agree to be texted. And so that's really a really big advantage that I see in my current practice.
Yeah, I mean, I applaud it because I think it's fantastic, but, you know, a lot of businesses have been texting their clients without having to call them back and wait for them to make an appointment. The amount of time saved just in tiny small adjustments is amazing. But so you currently, let's just clear this up, so I'm not even sure I'm aware, currently GP in an NHS practice and private as well?
Not yet, but I'm going to be working privately soon.
So you've had some exposure to the different environments of NHS GP versus...
Yeah, I'll probably be able to comment on that more in the next few months, but...
In the next episode,
the
we follow
episode,
up.
The next episode, thanks. Yeah. Hopefully I'll come back.
Yeah.
I mean, the NHS has been my predominant source of my experience so far, and... coming back to my sort of career changes, I eventually, I became a GP trainee, and then I had my first child. I eventually realised some sort of concept that I was interested in a different way of using my skill base and my knowledge base to give information and accurate information, because there is so much inaccurate information out there and so much anxiety that's created as a response from reviewing that information online, and that's
basically, people searching on Google, I've got a thing on my finger, and then adding two up, getting to 22.
And a lot. So some of what we do in consultation is looking at sort of myth busting and looking at the evidence that people are bringing to you. I looked at this. I mean, one of the sort of staple phrases that patients do come in with is, well, I've looked it up on Google and I know I shouldn't have done that. And so they know, they're searching for the information. They want the information. They want the information to find that out themselves. So they're taking a proactive response to what their issue is. But they're not really able to come up with the right conclusions. And there are things out there that can help them. So just being aware of what the best websites are, for example, for those problems. And that will be, that's really specific. But, you know, we use the NHS website, NHS UK website, a lot. Patient.co.uk can be helpful.
So one of the first things is like, where have you been, where did you get this information from?
Exactly. Or some occasionally says not so much anymore, but they used to bring like a newspaper clipping or something they found in a tabloid newspaper. and some of this, you know, some of that stuff is really important because it's really emotive and it's driving what people's anxieties are. So it's important to look at it on that level. But helping people to get the best information, depending on what the problem is and depending on if it's a child or if it's an adult. There's a new NHS app, which I would say is really worth downloading because it's also sort of a navigation tool that you can find out lots of NHS written content about different problems. But still, if you don't know what the problem is, you're just making lots of assumptions.
And still get lost. And I guess that you're not going to be able to remove the need for being able to sit down with a doctor who's got a broad range of experience and they can guide you, you know, if necessary, to a specialist in the right field that
if needs be. And there's lots being done actually in sort of consultation models in general practice, looking at online consultation chats and you know, sort of more WhatsApp type models, which there hasn't really been a major, the jury's not really out yet on that one, but there are a lot of online consultations going on now. Babylon is one of the big ones. Yeah. So people are engaging with doctors in different scenarios. It's not always sit down face to face, which, you know, I believe is the best model, but economically it's not always so feasible.
Yeah, I mean, I guess a little small amount of change can have a big impact. So let's talk about Smart About Health, because that was really useful. I learned a lot about you, which is what I wanted to do. And just try and get into the sort of psyche of, you mentioned that you had some time off, you got an opportunity to look up and think about, you know, how could you maybe use your skills in a different way? Mm. We've obviously started engaging because I guess our paths are crossing more, that you're starting to think about business, and I haven't been to the GP for probably 15 years, so it's unlikely I was going to bump into you there.
You're just so healthy, Duncan.
Well, I'm trying, and I tried to get on with it, and I don't read anything online about what I may or may not have. I just try to kind of be more aware of what's going on with myself. I mean, I have been to the hospital for kidney stones and things that you can't avoid, but I know a lot of people do get sort of fixated on, you know, needing to find out right now what's going on. Like, I think you said kids as well. Fortunately, both my boys are incredibly happy and incredibly healthy, so hopefully I won't need to go to the GP for any reason. But Smart About Health sort of just captured me, because you've captured me at a time where I've started to think more about culture, building new businesses, and trying to use what I've learned to filter down and to genuinely trying to make people's lives better and more palatable. Because having built a team before and had lots of employees, I've kind of felt the pain points of what people do and don't like and what makes them less willing or able to do the job at hand. And then we started talking about what you're doing, which I think's fantastic. We've taken that to the next level. Today you came in and Tab hosted you at our head office, and already people are saying to me, that was amazing, you know, great. So I know it's evolving every day, because we, you know, we've spoken a couple of times recently. What's your vision for Smart About Health? It's a long-winded question.
It is. And I think maybe I'll just finish off the journey story and then we'll come on to that. Because we've been talking for probably a couple of years now about this now. So initially, after I parked all my ideas after I had my first daughter, went back to medicine, and it was on my second maternity leave that I decided, right, I'm really going to actually do this. So part of the reason for me doing this, initially the concept was really only based about parents and health of children and parents. Okay. And it was all driven by my own experience as a mum, as a new mum, for the second time.
Yeah.
But also about this realization that people just really need to know and feel empowered to take better control of their own health. And how I was gonna deliver that, and what would my business model be in delivering that? So, when I had my second daughter, I found it really difficult. I find being off work a sort of destructive process for me, and that's just me. And I did get some symptoms of postnatal depression with my second daughter, but I think really what got me better was doing something. This really kept me focused. It made me feel like I am doing something. I'm not working because I'm on maternity leave, but I'm now creating something new, something important, something that matters to me. And that really inspired me and got me going and got me out of the postnatal depression. And I can't say that I had severe postnatal depression. I didn't. But postnatal depression is a whole nother topic.
I guess with that, that's the type of thing, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but it starts to creep in, and it's only when things get on top of you that takes more of a foothold. And maybe because you're more aware of the symptoms as you describe them, or you know, that you had an opportunity to, or luckily you found this thing that sort of distracted you.
I think that's it. It sort of distracted me and it gave me other focus, because actually, you know, and this is part of the sort of taboo topics that I'll explain a bit more to you about, but, you know, mental health for doctors, you know, you're not superhuman. We're all human. And doctors themselves, there's a high proportion of mental health problems that come in the medical profession because of the extreme stress that you're put under and what the decisions that you're having to make every day. But, you know, the feeling, and it shouldn't be this way, is that, well, you know, I shouldn't get postnatal depression because I am a medical professional. Now, that doesn't make any sense. That's a completely irrational thought.
Even saying it out loud sounds silly.
I mean, it sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? But, you know, for doctors to even come out and say, I've got a mental health problem, or I'm stressed, it has these negative connotations, and I think that's wrong. It shouldn't be that way, because we are all human, we all have challenges. I think that what's drummed into you as a doctor is that you're resilient. This is why you're a doctor. This is how you've made it this far. You're just so resilient. And I just find that concept really difficult, because what does it mean if you're not resilient enough? And does it mean that you're just not good enough?
Everyone. There's a fine balance footballers, you know, same. They told to, you know, you're a team player and it's not all about you. And there's all these things. I guess a lot of that, from my perspective, is just giving yourself the opportunity to be positive and to sort of combat these fears or issues that you may have. But then, like you said, everyone's human. It creeps up on the least expected person at the worst possible time. And, you know, it seems to be really starting to roll in the right direction, that people can talk about postnatal depression without having to worry about what their friends are going to think. Yeah. Or can think about.
And there's so much being done. And, you know, my focus is on the workplace being a really responsible source for all of these interventions, because it takes up so much of your time working, and it's such a big important factor in causing work-related illness and you know, just your life. It is your life. A lot of the time it's a big predominant factor in your life. So I sort of moved on from the parent angle, which is still part of our offering, which is looking really at what matters to parents, what's really going on, what are the real issues parents are facing. These are things I see every day in my general practice. Yeah. About a third of my patients are children, in particular young children, and probably about a third of my patients are mental health. And what I decided was...
Which is a very broad...
Yeah, topic. That's a very broad topic. Yeah. I think that's for another podcast, probably.
Yeah, definitely.
But my thoughts were, look, actually, as a doctor, first of all, I've got all these contacts with other specialists, which is amazing. You know, we can get exposure to really important but expert topics and bring that to people. So in terms of looking at what is a reliable source of information and improving access to that, because you're going to pay a lot of money to see somebody privately if you just want an opinion, if you just want an idea of what's going on.
Yeah.
We can bring that out and we can roll that out potentially to the public, but the initial th- thought was that we would roll that out to organisations, big, small, whatever the size. Everybody is wanting to improve the well-being of their staff, because well-being is not just when you're at work, it's all of life.
So I
moved on to thinking about Smart About Health, and this evolved over lots of different ideas that we had. We had all sorts, didn't we? Uber Doctor, and that's being done, by the way. And that's a great concept, and looking at maybe like a health concierge, lots of different ideas, but actually looking at evolving my original idea, because I didn't actually realise, could that original idea about giving health information, inspiring and empowering people to take better control of their health and well-being for themselves and for their families, is that a business thing? And now we've realised it is. And Smart About Health is...
I just want to quickly just to interject, because I always invite people to talk to me about their companies, and I always talk about pitch me this and pitch me that, but this isn't something I've invested in. We haven't got to the point. We've just spent a lot of time talking over the years, because I'm genuinely interested, and I think there's an opportunity for you to kind of deliver this message. But I didn't want anyone to think that it was all about me trying to promote you or promote the business. I just feel, with or without you, that this is something that TAB should have in its DNA. And I really enjoy just talking to you about it. So. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad.
I think your opinion is extremely valuable, and I know you're going to talk about the expert-led side, but I think, especially from kind of just being in business, there's so many opinions from everywhere, and I think there's a lack of, and what I felt actually sitting in your talk today was that you're coming from just a different level of experience in this subject than, you know, somebody who's not a professional.
Yeah, I think that... what we consider to be our unique selling point is expertise, is that we have a team, we've got GPs, we've got physiotherapists, we've got medical consultants, we've got paediatricians, we've got nutritionists, we've got psychologists, and we're trying to enable other people to get access to the information from those people and ask questions and actually engage with them, and then use that expertise in the workplace to create a more positive culture about health and well-being, and use that information to inspire conversations, policy changes, getting imprinted in the DNA of companies, because it's their responsibility, not entire responsibility, because you are responsible for your own health, but to give people the opportunity and the information that they need to take better control of their own health. So one of our main objectives is really, we're talking about proactive rather than reactive health. And what I do on a daily basis is a real mixture of that. So as a GP,
very reactive, on the basis that people, you don't get a chance to say anything to someone until they've come to you with a problem.
In that sense, yes. Although, there's other channels that you can try and reach people that is evolving. But when you work in a hospital, it's very reactive. Okay, somebody comes, they've got pain in their tummy, they've got appendicitis. You react to that by doing the operation, taking it out. And part of my job in general practice is is reactive health, because people come to me with a problem. So they're already experiencing the problem, and they want to understand more about the problem and potentially get a solution to that problem. And we work together with the patient to try and enable them to get the right solution for them. But a big part of our job is proactive and preventative medicine. So looking at risk factors, reducing risk factors, interventions and screening to try and improve people's health from the start or from the beginning. And that's a big part of what Smart About Health does. So Smart About Health, proactive health and well-being, and blending that with expertise and real life. So what we also want to do is to really get the human factor brought into what we're doing. So not only do we have experts, so in whatever their field is, talking about their specific topics, we've also got real lived experience, so people can relate to that and feel inspired, empowered, and feel able to have conversations in the workplace, at home.
Definitely.
And live with it.
Yeah. I think also we've talked about a lot of things that have become more sort of become more accepted to talk about. But there's also a ton of things, you know, like mental health, which is obviously a huge issue. You just said a third of your I was going to say customers, but they're definitely not customers. A third of your patients are want to talk about this huge broad subject, but there's also a huge amount of other things going on, and we're sort of honing in specifically on the workplace. And we've talked just from a commercial level about employers' responsibility to do a lot more than they ever had to do. I mean, I grew up in an era where you left your problems at home. You come to work, you work from 9 till 5, you leave your problems at the door. And I think, you know, that was a generation after it was, you know, much, much worse, much, much more harsh than that. Mm. Now, I think that as that's changed, there is a corporate responsibility to look after your employees. And even more so, you know, as people spend 50, 60, 70, 80% of their waking lives working for an organisation, that there is a need to keep people happy and healthy, just purely from some of the stats that you've shown me, that the financial impact it can have on any business. So I'm interested to hone in on some of those points.
Yeah, and I think it is becoming much more prioritised by organisations, big and small. So it doesn't matter what size your organisation is, the well-being and the health of your employees is becoming much higher in the list of objectives than it was in those days, where it was leave your problems at home, you're here to work. And the realisation is that actually, unless you create the culture and the environment that people can actually be themselves and be open and be honest with their employers of what's going on, then you're not going to necessarily have a happy, healthy and productive employee population.
I'm going to put the aircon on listening.
Sure. And I think, you know, we discussed in the talk already that in terms of the working population, there was 131 million working days lost per year for ill health. That's a stat from public health.
Say that again, because it took me a few times to...
131 million days lost per year for ill health.
Yeah.
And that ill health is all-encompassing, of course. And within that, the majority of the days lost are sort of fairly evenly, but not entirely evenly, split between general health problems, so things that we can't necessarily control, coughs, colds, flu, but majority of the issues being musculoskeletal and mental health.
Yeah.
And as an employer, you know, what is your responsibility to help maintain somebody's mental health and their musculoskeletal health in particular, because when you're working all day, and I think a lot of the concept is in a lot of firms, it's absolutely the same in medicine, I feel it myself, is that you've got to be at your desk, you've got to be working all the time, and I know that you've got a different culture here in TAB, and you know, employers are realising more that that just creates burnout, it creates dissatisfaction, it creates problems, you know, really innately with the workforce, that you... And people will leave, and that's one of the financial problems for employers.
But you've got this drive now to actually change cultural behaviour, and I think we were talking downstairs, it's not just about I want to have a better culture and this is how I'm going to do it. It's you know, you need to get under the skin. You know, this isn't how, just because that's how it's done everywhere else, this is how we want to do things. And a lot of that has to come from, I would say, you know, inside out rather than outside in.
Absolutely.
You know, it's about trying to engage people and find out what their problems are.
Yeah.
And that leads to another issue, which is that a lot of these problems, people don't want to discuss with their boss or their manager or their, you know, their colleague. So it's a huge task.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a huge task for any organisation. And, people are already making the right steps by introducing all these mental health and well-being initiatives, and I think it's so positive.
Yeah.
You know, we have to view that as positive, and it's really the beginning of this journey of change within organisations. And already looking particularly at mental health having stigma attached to it, and how can companies? Lots of companies are doing a lot, and they're really investing in this. And there is a really good business case for investing in mental health of your employees. So why not extend that to what the other issues, which is what I see as a doctor, and this is where I think is where we can come in and give a unique perspective, is that looking, if you just want to look at those mental health problems, of course, mental health, physical health are completely intertwined.
Yeah.
There is such an overlap. There's such complexity. And when somebody's got stress, anxiety, and depression, which are the main things that are now being sort of talked about more in companies, then there's so many underlying reasons for that that companies should also be exploring. And as a doctor, we see the real issues. So, you know, I'm in such a privileged position. Sitting in my, at my desk every day, I see patients every 10 minutes, which has its own issues. But I'm probably the first person that somebody has told about the actual problems that they're having for many, many years.
Yeah.
And or I might be the only person that they've ever told.
Yeah.
And that is such an absolute privilege. But with that insight, I want to be able to give companies, share that insight and say, well, look, this is what I'm seeing. You know, there's a statistic from the British Menopause Society. So menopause is one of the topics that we cover because it's so important to the workforce.
Yeah.
But 47% of women felt that they could not disclose that menopause or menopausal symptoms were the reason that they took that day off work or they took that week off work. And
it's understood, it's important for men and women to understand equally, you know, these things that affect not just you, but the other people around you, and how to be aware and how to be sort of understanding. And they're just things that aren't, because there's other things on this taboo list of subjects we'll talk about.
Yeah.
There's loads of things that people, even breaking down these barriers of mental health and getting people, I mean, it's almost become a little bit just such a wide net that, you know, it doesn't give people the opportunity to actually understand or delve into those problems in more detail.
And I think, you know, we can't sort of run before we can walk.
Yeah.
So I think we have to really commend companies that are bringing in these interventions, and hopefully that will scale down to all size companies and everybody will have that outlook. So, you know, there's lots to be done with the underlying reasons for stress, depression, anxiety, for musculoskeletal problems, and then the impact that musculoskeletal problems have on mental health.
Explain what you mean, just in...
The musculoskeletal problems.
Yeah.
So problems with muscles and bones. So in particular, one, the main thing is back pain, neck pain from desk working. So that's has a real, that has a significant impact on days lost for those working reasons. However, you know, it also affects productivity, and it creates something called, so mental health and musculoskeletal and all these other issues that we'll talk about as well, taboo problems, create something called presenteeism. And that means being at work, but not really being able to fully, to work to your full capacity. So you're there, but you're not actually able to do your job.
I guess in some, I actually guess in some ways, everybody suffers a little bit from some of these things.
Yeah, I mean, we can't be 100% every day, of course. We're, you know, part of what we're really discussing is that we are all human.
Yeah.
We can't help things. You know, if we have a bad day or we have bad news, of course, we're not going to be necessarily fully engaged with what we're doing. But, you know, long term, it's about supporting people to be productive. And what we want to do is look at issues that are the real issues that matter to real people, and help employers get some real understanding of this and create real cultural change. So cultural change means, as you said, inside out, empowering and enabling your employees to form discussion groups, to inform policies internally and make changes. So not only do we want people just to be open about their mental health, of course, that's fantastic, but what else is going on? And people will find it a lot easier to be at work if they feel supported by their peers and their managers.
It's not like they're necessarily being supported outside of work. It's just, you know, that's better than not going to work and not feeling like you can explain. But I agree. I mean, I just haven't seen, it's a very, very new concept, but I haven't seen the ability to, you know, lay your cards on the table in an environment where everybody's there to support and help rather than, you know, I think it's just, I know I keep saying there's big, big barriers to break down.
Yes, and that's why I think we have to have a strategy. So what we have strategized in this for Smart About Health is offering this at different levels and for different problems. So really individualizing that problem and saying, well, look, at what level is somebody going to engage with getting support for, let's say, fertility problems, which is a really huge problem for working age people, because most people are going to want to have a child. And obviously it affects men and women and affects the couple's relationship. And once you've decided you want to have a baby, and this is me knowing as a mother, that once you decide you want to have a baby,
that's the most important thing.
And if you're having fertility issues, or if you had miscarriages, or you've discovered that there's other underlying problems, and that is what you're fixated on.
Yeah.
And you know,
and no amount of work or no amount of distraction, no amount of support really can sort of break that down.
I mean, to a degree, but I think what we're offering is expertise. So do people know where they can turn to, or how can they get the right information? And could that be made available from an employer's perspective? So could you roll out a program where we're actually giving expert-led information about fertility issues? And then could that also create a buzz around that and actually create peer-to-peer support? So maybe somebody has had that experience and are willing to speak out about it and willing to support people on a human level within their organisation.
How do you see this work on a practical level?
So, like,
because we talked about policies and procedures and implementing. Like, if you could rewrite the rule book of how sort of open people were with their issues or their taboo subjects.
I mean, you know, you don't have to be open. It's completely your choice, of course. But lots of people do want to get more information, get more support. That's a lot of the things on social media is about that. And in particular on some of the baby groups that I'm on, you know, there's a lot of trying to have peer support. But, you know, when you're in a work environment, it's also about how can you stay in work and actually do your job? Because nobody wants to leave their job, really. Not an outcome that most people want. Or to find that their job is too stressful because they can't manage, you know, what's going on. But for organisations, I think creating things like networks, creating, direct line manager support, having policies written, really considering what the actual struggles their employees are having. So not just hypothesising what those issues are, but in order to create those and to have that inside-out approach, you have to ignite some sort of passion and some sort of willingness from your employees to speak out. It might not necessarily be your employees, it could be employees from another company. And we have something in the NHS called the Expert Patient Programme. So it's a similar model. It's looking at a patient who's been through that journey with that condition. They've come through it. It might be massive weight loss. It might be they've reversed diabetes or whatever it is. And we're using them to inspire other patients in those positions. And we're also utilising different models of consultation. So, yes, okay, it's all right to come to me and talk to me directly about your diabetes. And that's me and you as a patient talking about your problem. But you don't know necessarily how, you know, what's going on with other people. So creating group consultations, this is a method that is being initiated and tried in the NHS, particularly looking at diabetes. It really has potentially a very positive response because you're now thinking, well, look, I'm not alone.
Yeah.
There's other people going through the
it's
same
not just
struggles.
This one person who's telling me their perspective.
Exactly. Sometimes a doctor-patient relationship can be difficult because having that peer-to-peer or that layperson perspective can be really powerful, and that can be what drives change. And I think what can drive change in organisations is, yes, us coming in, we want to give our expertise and we want to give people the right information and messages through different ways. Maybe that's an internet platform. Maybe that's coming in face-to-face, which is what we do at the moment.
Yeah.
To come in face-to-face to run sessions within
organisations. But you want to empower people to be able to do it from within.
From within the organisation, Because if you want to have a policy to support people with fertility issues, then you need that experience, and you also need to know, well, what goes on the other side medically and psychologically.
Yeah, you need to be able to deal with, I've got the issue right now, or I've had the issue and I've come out the other side, or I didn't even know I was ever going to need this support, and now all of a sudden I do.
Exactly.
And you can't cover for everything all at the same time.
No, you can't cover for everything, absolutely. And I think that would be just too much of a mammoth task, and, you know, even mental health itself.
So give us like six subjects you would like, or you currently offer. What are the things that you, and if you get freezing cold, let me know.
Thank you.
Are you cold?
Only marginally.
You're getting there.
I'm all right. So in terms of, you know, we do cover topics.
Do you want a tab hoodie to wear?
Do you want me to wear a tab hoodie?
I do.
That's the question, right? Do you make them to suit me?
We'll definitely suit you.
Musculoskeletal health, mental health and lifestyle health are really big topics.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of them are being done to a degree. So our, in terms of our lifestyle health, we are looking at preventative and proactive health and looking at the future, which is quite a hard concept for people to get, but because it's so silent, it's not really in front of you. But that's our proactive, not reactive approach to health. And within that, we're looking at cardiovascular disease and diabetes, weight management,
somebody
sleep.
Like most people are touched by the subject somewhere, yes. Even if it's not them, you know, if they go home, like someone brought up cancer this morning, and you know, hopefully you'll never have that yourself, but it's likely that somewhere in your family
absolutely.
It will be affecting the kind of, you know, affecting you and your life in some way or shape or
so
form.
One in two people are affected by cancer. Doesn't mean they have cancer, but they're affected by cancer. And cancer is such an emotive topic. That is one of the topics we discuss. And it's more of an awareness topic. It's more looking at how people can be either, you know, limit their risk factors for developing cancer. We do go on about smoking, but that is such a big contributing factor. But also looking at how to spot early signs. It's not trying to make people worried and paranoid. And it's also looking at how organisations can empower people to detect early signs. So there was one big organisation, very big bank, that has information in the toilets to say, and this is looking at blood in the urine, okay, so blood in your pee.
Yeah.
If you see blood in the urine just once, you've got to go to your doctor because it could be something serious. So there's lots of national public health campaigns that are being used and utilised in organisations to help inspire health within their employee population. But what we want to focus on, as well as these three core areas, so musculoskeletal health, mental health, lifestyle health, is personal health topics. So this is where I see us having our unique advantage, being healthcare professionals, being on the front line every day, seeing what people are really coming in and talking to us about. And that's, so you asked for a list of sort of other topics. So we might cover women's health, we cover men's health, sexual health, you know, things that really matter to people, and then looking at carers' health. So this is bringing it back to my original idea to helping parents understand more about health. But it's not just, so you're not just a carer if you're a carer of a child. You might be a carer of an older adult.
Yeah.
And that creates its own stress and anxiety and needs in itself. And supporting, as we get older, our parents might be getting older. We are maybe a carer ourselves.
Yeah.
And we might have needs. And employers should be seen to be looking after the needs for carers, because they're the ones that are probably going to need to take time off work to look after their elders, or maybe because of stress and anxiety related to that. Coming into the sort of really the nitty-gritty of our topic, so fertility is a big issue. Menstruation.
I found that when, I mean, I went through IVF, and I've always been very open. I kind of pride myself on being transparent and trustworthy, and I like to be open. I just found it shocking how, this was quite a few years ago as well, when I started talking about, oh, I'm going through IVF and we're on our third try and this went well and this went badly, people are like, oh, can I talk to you afterwards? You know, I've been doing some of that. I didn't want to talk about it in the room. And I'm like, it's just strange how, I guess it was like generations of keep your personal things to yourself. So it's interesting to hear you talk about that. It's still, you know, still a topic that obviously affects loads of people. There's so many more options available to people now.
Right.
So the only way to find out about them is to talk about it and to communicate and seek help. You know, just this is a small issue of itself. Again, people might not even know that this is ever going to affect them. So it's important to pay a bit of attention and to kind of be open-minded, I think, from certainly from an employer point of view, but also from an employee point of view, just to understand that that person that you rely heavily on might need to some time or some space, and you know, that all of these individual issues are important. Go on, sorry, I jumped in.
Not at all. And I think it's really, you know, it's really poignant, because actually if you can't tell your employer that you're having fertility problems or you're undergoing IVF, you're having hormone treatment, whatever you're going through, how can they best support you? You know, they can't really necessarily, you can't expect them to have the right tools and techniques because they just don't know.
Yeah, so there's a responsibility for them to do something for you that they don't know currently, that they don't know about. So, you know, it's a kind of catch 22.
It is. And I suppose for Smart About Health, what we want to do is try and get into organisations to drive the confidence of those employees to come forward and say, well, what's actually going on with them, and therefore inform change and cultural change within that organisation. But what we want to do is give them the right information. So we've got fertility specialists that will give them that information that they might need to understand which pathway they're going down or what they need to be considering. And then we have people with lived experience, so like yourself, that are willing to come. And not everybody is at the stage where they're willing to talk about their experience or where they've come. Like, you've got two children, so you know, you might feel more positive about talking about it now. So having one people set, that Laura, they can relate to is really important, as well as just having that expertise. And therefore driving the ambition is that this will drive maybe even a network to form where people will meet other people within their organisation who are having the same issue. So that forms peer-to-peer support, camaraderie, and advice. You know, you can give each other advice. That's fantastic. And therefore looking at how that information, that really valuable information, can be filtered to their employer to actually make changes. So how can they best support their employees? And that's just a really positive step to looking at health and well-being in the workplace.
Agreed. And, you know, from my point of view, we've started on the journey today of actually trying to show, you know, I think it's a good idea. And we've started to present that to some of the TAB team today. And, yeah, I'm just feeling already that just purely, you know, for me, it's easy to preach this kind of cultural change. But unless we go through the effort that it takes to make sure our diaries aligned and make sure everybody's present and understands what they're about to do, it is difficult to take these small steps that are required in order to change. And I think you are not quite there yet with exactly how it's going to look, but I see it evolving every day. And I think it's an unbelievable task to be taking on, and I hope to be able to help you with it on your journey. How are we doing for time?
An hour or 3 minutes.
Fine. I think we're going to wrap it up.
Yeah.
To wrap it up, maybe we should talk about where they can find more information.
Yeah. From Laura.
Your website.
Yeah. It's definitely something. If anybody's interested in trying to promote this either to their firm or to their boss so that they can filter this down, what would you recommend they do?
Well, I mean, first of all, I'd recommend that they contact me because I'd love to speak to them.
How would they do that?
So they can go to my website, www.smartabouthealth.co.uk.
Yeah.
And that's got my email there, or you can leave a comment and you can go through the website. And obviously, if it's any of your contacts, we'd be very happy to speak to them directly.
Yeah, we'll put all the links in the descriptions and everything that we need to do so that you know how to find Laura directly.
And then you can find me on LinkedIn as well, Dr. Laura David, and that's me. But, you know, we want to get this into organisation. We're already working with some organisations and we're making really positive changes. We've had amazing feedback, and I suppose I'll just leave it with something that is from one of our recent sessions, which was a really big bank, international bank, and it was a men's health session. I did some of it myself, and I was working with one of our urology specialists. He's a consultant urologist, and we were really lucky that they actually incorporated men's health into their wellbeing week. It was during a wellbeing week, which was the first week that they've actually done, so they're taking the first step in the right direction to bring in expertise, and they had lots of other speakers come in. And we spoke about some of the topics we discussed today, which is looking at preventing health problems that are more common in men, but my colleague in particular talked about specific male health problems, talking about different types of cancer. So what is really on people's minds, talking about male sexual health problems. So it's a really taboo topic in a way, because people don't feel that open talking about it. But we were so surprised at sort of the level of engagement that we got and the questions that were being asked about sexual health in men in a group, scenario. And there were lots of other people dialed in on the phone. But at the end of the session, we had one of the employees, he stood up and he thanked us for the session and being really informative. And he thanked his organisation for enabling this kind of session to be run there. And he disclosed to everybody in the room and on the phone that he was a survivor of testicular cancer. And we, during the men's health session, we went through some of the barriers that men often find in terms of seeking healthcare professional advice. And he reflected on his own experience, saying that he found a lump in his testicles and he disclosed this to his wife eventually, who, and it was the, she was the catalyst to making him go and seek medical opinion. And he was operated on the next day because it was a cancerous lump. And that's, he's here today to tell the story. Amazing. And inspire his colleagues. And that's what we want to see from individuals, is hopefully give them the opportunity to feel that they can disclose, and to not only their managers but to their other, to their other colleagues, and make everybody realize that we all have health and we all have health problems, physical, mental, and everything in between.
Very good. I also do want you, before you go, just to reiterate some of the stats that you've, I know like some of them we touched on briefly, but some of the stats are, I would say, shocking, maybe from your other presentation as well, just over the it'd be interesting to hear, and maybe we'll run this at the end, and also we might create something slightly different out of it as well.
Okay. Well, I suppose, you know, what we talked about in the original presentation was just giving a bit of background about why health in the workplace is so important, not only for employees, of course it is, but for the employers, and why they should be doing more. So looking at health conditions at work, there were 131 million working days lost to sickness absence every year, which we discussed that fact already in the podcast. And that's been broken down. This is from Public Health England, from surveys that they've done. 28.2 million days were lost for musculoskeletal problems, and the rest of them, so 14.3 million for stress, anxiety and depression, and then 34.3 for minor illnesses or other illnesses. But if you imagine that this is great, this is really important statistics, but what is going on within those statistics is unknown and untapped. But as a doctor, we have a much a better understanding of what are the underlying issues, especially within that stress, anxiety and depression, and what are the causes of that, and how can we potentially improve understanding around those causes. And then there's a lot of evidence looking at work-related health illness, and that was 2017-18 study. So, you know, the number here was 30.7 million days lost due to work-related ill health. So people identifying that the work was the confounding problem here, in why they took time off work. And it cost the wider economy, so that's looking at worklessness and sickness absence, approximately 100 billion annually. So there's a really strong case for action for employers, and obviously wider than that. So we, you know, there are interventions being looked at by the government. The government have just come out with a new report looking at health is everyone's business. So it's particularly looking at health in the workplace and inspiring organisations to put better interventions and more expert-led interventions into their workplace wellbeing policies. The main research has been done around mental health. So that's where the business cases lie at the moment, but there's a lot to be said for building business cases for these other topics as well. And as I said, those are all the underlying reasons, well, partly the underlying reasons for lots of those mental health problems. So looking at Deloitte in 2017, did a report for the government looking at mental health and the cost of mental health in the workplace. So the numbers are looking at absenteeism, staff turnover, so people leaving, and presenteeism, which is quite an interesting concept. And that's looking at people, as we said already,
people who come to work who aren't actually mentally there.
Not able to do their work
or not focused on their work.
And so the employer's not getting the most out of that employee. Yeah. So absenteeism, they've estimated for mental health in the workplace to cost $8 billion a year. Same with staff turnover. But the biggest loss is around presenteeism. They estimated this to be $17 to $26 billion per year. And this is sort of staggering cost.
They're staggering figures.
To the employer. And thinking about the wider impact on the economy, on the NHS, all these people coming
it's
to the
huge.
NHS. And not being in work and not paying taxes and putting money back into their to their country. And what Deloitte interestingly looked at in their study was where should, on the whole journey of health in the workplace, where should interventions lie? Where is the highest return of investment? And they focused on awareness, so awareness campaigns, awareness sessions, which is where we focus it with a lot of our sessions, proactive measures, so improving understanding and also looking at how they can actually give people information and prevent things happening, and then the reactive measures that they have in place. So a lot of that is maybe things to do also with private health insurance and giving people the access to healthcare professionals when they need it. But the return of investment for early measures, so awareness and proactive measures, is as high as 8 to 1 in this study. So there's a lot of support for actually the business case for bringing in really effective, lots of these, you know, lots of these interventions don't have a lot of stats behind them because this is still relatively new. It's really emerging. The understanding isn't quite there. We don't know really what exactly matters to people yet. But there is definitely a business case for bringing this type of intervention into the workplace.
Most definitely. Thank you so much for your time. There's still loads to cover, and I'm sure as your business develops, we'll start to get more stuck into exactly how you're feeling it's going with trying to change cultural behaviour. I've really enjoyed speaking to Laura. It's been a lot of fun today. You've put in a lot of time and effort, so I really do appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll see you soon.
See you soon.
Fantastic.